now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now Intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. That's no reason for low quality.
People come for the conversation, but they stay for the low quality, Dean Haglund.
We're lo-fi.
This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I am Phil Lairness, and down under, for the first time, live in several weeks, here is Mujahideen, Dean Haglund. How are
you? Yay! Hi, everybody. How are you? It's good to be live.
You've been traveling while we've been playing pre-recorded shows, and don't kid yourself, excellent pre-recorded shows all about the greatest comedy films of all time.
Right.
Were you in New Zealand? Is that correct?
I was in New Zealand, including what every New Zealand tourist must do, a visit to Hobbit Town, the 43 Hobbits, no, 51 now, I think. Little Hobbit houses from the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit set. They kept it permanently, and now it's a big tourist attraction. Lovely scenery. A fun thing to do on an afternoon if you're in the Auckland, Hamilton area.
I would absolutely not do that. I would not. I could not give, in the words of Jessica Jones, I could not give a dead moose's final shit about that. But
because you're Canadian,
I would love to go on a Flight of the Conchords tour. I would love to go
That's filmed in New York, right? I mean, they are
a Taika. You know, it hasn't been filmed in years. You do know that also, right?
Yeah, right.
I would like to go on a Taika Waititi tour, see all the places where What We Do in the Shadows and Hunt for the Wilder People were filmed. That would be fun for me.
You know, that's a TV series also. It's not just a movie.
Flight of the Conchords.
No.
What We Do in the Shadows, they adapted it into a series. Well, hey,
yeah,
good
yeah,
for
yeah.
them. Good for them. And this is the show you want to turn for all the latest in local New Zealand broadcasting options. What were you doing in New Zealand other than getting your Hobbit on?
Well, listen, you know, there's many a distraction in Sydney, and I needed to focus on a certain graphic novel that I'm working on.
You went to New Zealand just to work on a graphic novel?
Well, yeah, that's true, because I got holed up in a hotel by the airport. Well, Patty was at the offices, the corporate offices down there, over there, across the ditch, as they call it.
So you were there for any kind of convention? Or whatnot? Okay, because you've been there for conventions before.
I've been there for conventions, and in fact, there were conventions going on in Sydney. SupernovaCon, of course, added again.
Yeah,
and
many of our friends, people we've worked with, were there. David Soboloff was there, and you were nowhere to be found.
Nowhere to be found. So specifically, went and hid myself, absconded myself. 8 hours a day in a tiny hotel room with no scenery, just an airport across the street as the only restaurant to dine at, and got some major work done. Some 235 different panel drawings done digitally. Now begin the color process, the whole thing.
So, in other words, we are right on schedule to debut the graphic novel at long last at the big X-Files convention in New Jersey this fall.
Yeah, let's say maybe.
If you miss that, that is an opportunity. You know, in the words of the Cappuccino Kid, an opportunity lost is a lifetime of regret, my friend.
Geez, well, you know, how many of those do I have? Let's line them up.
The quotes that I am bringing you today are varied. They are wide-ranging. The sources, no bounds. Well, exciting. You are coming, though, before that, before the big move, before the big convention in Jersey. You are actually coming stateside in like a matter of weeks, right?
Matter of weeks, but unfortunately, we'll be only maybe less than 48 hours in Los Angeles. So we're going to have to carefully time if we're doing a podcast face-to-face in the offices.
We have so much to get to that we will not do a production meeting on the air. We'll save that for after the recording.
Save that.
But so maybe 48 hours here and then to hit Detroit to look for new digs, right?
Look for new digs. That's right. How exciting.
When does that trip take place?
That's mid-July somewhere. We don't even have that planned out.
Wow.
How bad is that? I know. Well, I know. In the meantime, I'll be hosting the WebFest award show in Melbourne next week. So anybody in the Melbourne area that's got a web series up, come and come to the WebFest award ceremony.
Forgive
held at
a layperson, a geographical layperson's question, but is it possible, or is this just ridiculous? Is it possible that traveling to Melbourne takes longer for you than traveling to New Zealand?
You are geographically ignorant. That is not the case. Melbourne is a 1 hour flight. And New Zealand is a four-hour flight.
Are you flying to Melbourne?
I am, yes.
Okay.
Because driving is actually 8 hours.
See, that's what I was going to say. Or the train, right? Because you've taken the train, I think, before to Melbourne.
I've taken it to Canberra, not to Melbourne. Canberra is halfway between the two. But yes, the journey, the land journey, is scenic and beautiful and time-consuming. So...
You know,
I recommend it for those who have the time.
When we get to the end of the show and there's so much we didn't get to, I can't. you just know. It's like, why the F
why
did you guys waste so much time on this? And it's hilarious because we haven't.
You're asking the question.
I know. Well, we haven't chatted in so long that why not?
I know.
You
why
never,
not?
As George Carlin used to always say, you never ever saw a memo. From Monday morning timed 9:01 a.m. You never did, right? Because people had to come into the office and catch up. That's how this show started. We would come in after a weekend and we would just chat about what we'd seen and the trains to Melbourne that we did not take. You'll be excited to know that finally, I think, corrected and finished all deliverables for the Lady Killers. So a release date is forthcoming probably this week. Also have finally locked in a wedding date for Lily and myself, as well as venues for the ceremony itself and the reception. So a lot of big news on my end that we won't get into because we need to open up the Chill Pack Morgue, my friends.
Oh, man.
Celebrity deaths.
Yes, and quite an unusual celebrity death to begin. Laid to rest yesterday in Woodside, California, the beloved lowland gorilla Coco, who died at 46 years of age. You remember Coco?
Coco had a vocabulary of about 1,000 to 2,000 words, if I'm not mistaken.
1,000? Very good. 1,000-word vocabulary and could understand 2,000 words. Could communicate 1,000. Yes, amazing. 46 years. That's a good run. I thought for sure Coco was no longer with us, and I actually had just seen Coco in a theatrical release motion picture on Friday night, and then find out the next day Coco is being laid to rest. Coco died actually on Lily's birthday this week, the 19th. Born on the 4th of July. Coco was a patriot, born on the 4th of July in 1971. So just shy of 47 years of age. What an amazing... Right. The story, you know, of course, is that I love is how much Coco loved kittens, right?
Love kittens, exactly.
Always adopted kittens and even would nurse the kittens, she would, when yeah. she was younger. So anyway, quite an extraordinary story, that Coco.
And, yes.
And how glad are you, I know I am, that the woman, Ms. Patterson, Dr. Patterson, who first came into contact with Coco when they were performing, you know, scientific studies, and then mm-hmm. adopted Coco, was able to raise the money when Coco was, I think, 9 months old to adopt Coco outright, that Ms. Patterson, 71 years old now, is still alive and was alive throughout Coco's lifespan. It's pretty special, pretty remarkable that Coco was able to enjoy such a, you know, a long-standing relationship with its
right.
With its person, I guess we could say. So also leaving us this week, as our friend Alex Lefchuk on the Midweek Drive said, this woman headed off to Heaven FM. It was Eunice Gayson, and Gayson played an important role for Alex as a co-presenter on the Midweek Drive, but was, of course, a well-known actress, having played a major role in the Hammer horror film The Revenge of Frankenstein, and having appeared on television in such series as The Saint, which starred, of course, future James Bond Roger Moore, and The Avengers, and she played the Baroness Elsa Schrader in the 1962 London production of The Sound of Music, during which time she was cast and filmed her scenes for the first two Bond films, Dr. No, and From Russia with Love, as Sylvia Trench. She was the erstwhile girlfriend of James Bond in those first two James Bond movies, and the idea was she was going to be in all of them until they got around to making Honor Majesty's Secret Service, when, of course, she would marry James Bond and be killed.
Right.
And so, of course, the producers had the idea in mind of, well, no, let's change it up. Let's give him a different Bond girl in every movie. So she only appeared in two, but really made a mark in those films. And, of course, is the woman that says at the outset of Dr. No, I admire your luck, mister, which cues the most famous introductory line in motion picture history, Bond, James Bond.
Right. Fantastic. So she set the template for the Bond girl, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. So lovely. She remained a regular in London theater, appeared in many other productions, including The Grass is Greener in 1971, and as late as the 1990s in Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods.
Wow. That's a long run on the old stage, isn't it?
Now, another man who seemed to have quite a long run, though I was sort of surprised to find that it wasn't as long as I thought it was, because in a very short order, this man became, I think it's safe to say, the gold standard for most of us who host shows of some kind. And this is Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah. What a surprise.
A celebrity chef and food writer. Was it a surprise? People say that this is a surprise. People always act surprised. I guess we still just have a hard time believing that anyone rich and famous could commit suicide. And yet it happens. And it happens because you find out that fame and fortune doesn't make everything better. Doesn't.
No.
Make the demons go away. And of course, this is a man by his own admission and who is very open about a long-standing battle with heroin.
Right.
So we say a surprise. And again, coming just 3 days after fashion designer Kate Spade killed herself in her Park Avenue apartment, right?
Right. It's a cluster of suicides.
So anyway, but we don't want to celebrate, obviously, how he died so much as we want to celebrate his achievement. And really, right. You're a foodie, and you're a foodie from the from the point of view of, like, you know, you love putting together recipes. You love figuring out what you can make from what gets delivered. And
right.
You know, and I don't watch these shows ever for that. But he was really good at what he did. As a television host, as an interviewer, there's a little bit of, I think, him and how he went about it in how you interview people in Truth is out there.
No, thank you.
But he was able to really get people to open up in some pretty profound ways without ever asking truly probing questions.
Yeah.
Just by making them relaxed.
Making them relaxed and being engaged and actually, you know, enjoying just being in the company. I love that in the episodes of No Reservations that I did get to see that, you know, there was a relaxed quality to finding and discovering weird culinary, the culinary underbelly of different cities. Always so fascinating.
He achieved celebrity status after the publication of his 2000 book, Kitchen Confidential: Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, which created quite a sensation by combining frank details of his life and career with behind-the-scenes observations of the industry itself. And it was a very surprising crossover because it was a book intended for professional cooks and foodies, I guess, that had enormous mass appeal to the rest of us. He went on to achieve widespread fame thanks to his CNN series Parts Unknown, and he, of course, was filming a segment for that program when he was found dead. There has been quite the Alex Jones conspiracy theory. Of course there is, because if somebody dies and people are hurting, who's going to go and pee on the ashes and rub salt in the wound but Alex Jones? And his theory was that, of course, because no famous or rich person can ever commit suicide, that he was murdered, and he was murdered because he was about to go public with his support of Donald Trump.
What?
Yeah, so that's the conspiracy theory. Of course, Bourdain was going to do this. The same Anthony Bourdain who went to Russia in a 2013 episode of his show, a show in which everyone he met with ends up being assassinated because they were critical of Putin in the show. And in 2013, Anthony Bourdain draws the comparison and says, you know who Putin really reminds us New Yorkers of? Donald Trump.
Wow.
Yeah. He draws the comparison then before Trump ever was interested in becoming president. Anyway, there we go. Let's close up the Chill Pack Morgue and move into a little look back at our last couple shows, our top 10 comedies, which we spread out over two shows. I think we discussed more than 30 movies in those shows.
Yep.
And I was actually thinking, and I didn't jot them down was the thing. So maybe it'll occur to us in the weeks to come. But I was actually thinking every so often, oh my God, I can't believe we didn't even talk about this film or that film or what have you. But we got a couple emails. Oh, well, like what occurred to me? I mean, occur to me right off the top, which is The King of Comedy. We didn't even mention.
Oh,
and
right.
And. Well, yeah, what were you going to say? Well,
I never laughed at that one. That one was really close to home.
But that doesn't mean that it's not a comedy, right? I mean, and it doesn't mean that it's not perfect. I mean, it is truly a perfect movie. It's one of the greatest movies. And what genre would you put it in? I would argue that the only genre it really can be in is comedy. And if anybody had any doubt, I would point out that, as he often did, Martin Scorsese gave himself a cameo And who did he play in that movie? He played the director, right? He was the director the show. And what's his one line? What's his one line as the director of the show?
I don't know.
I think this is funny. So I think he weighed in on whether it was a comedy or not.
Right.
Right?
Right. I guess that does...
But you're right. That's why I didn't, because it's so painful. Though I do just laugh uncontrollably now. I mean, there is no scene that I'm not just cackling over. But the first time, way too much.
Way too much.
Yeah. But I mean, everything. The painful break-in of his house. The houseboy, Sandra Bernhardt's monologue when she's holding Jerry Lewis hostage. It's terrific.
It's terrific.
So
frightening.
Anyway, we got a couple letters.
Yes, let's hear them.
Not surprisingly, from the same person. Hello, Phil. Just a minor point, hardly worth mentioning, but Dean... referring to the movie Young Frankenstein, 1974, comments on how Mel Brooks had to fight to keep the Putting on the Ritz song in the picture. I once viewed an on-camera interview with Gene Wilder, which contradicts that statement. According to that interview, Wilder was told by Brooks that he wanted to take the number out. Wilder got upset at that notion and proceeded to give an impassioned plea to leave it in, stating why it belonged. Brooks, without argument, said, okay, leaving Wilder just a little perplexed. So Wilder asked Brooks straight out, what was all that all about? Brooks explained that he was unsure if the number was funny or if it was just being self-indulgent. Brooks decided that he would tell Wilder that he was going to take the number out just to see Wilder's reaction. Since Wilder had fought for it, Brooks felt that it was not just some self-indulgence and therefore had merit.
I think I was remembering that actual interview when I said that and merely got the protagonist and the antagonist mixed up. So thank you for pointing that out.
Well, you automatically, of course, blamed studio execs, as you do.
I know.
And that's,
maybe, you know what? That's a blind spot on my part.
Yeah, it is. And that came from Maurice Terenzio, who has written us so many times in the past. We always love hearing from him. And he did point out that although this was your mistake, I didn't correct you. So it was my mistake, too. And indeed, I've been so beaten down by the years that I often don't bother correcting you anymore.
Beaten down by my inaccuracies or just beaten down?
Yes and yes.
Ouch.
And then I heard, relax, Phil. Nobody's on the carpet. It is just that since you and Dean seem so fond of the movie Duck Soup, 1933, it may be interesting for the both of you to view two political satires that predate Duck Soup. Admittedly, these two comedies are inferior to Duck Soup, but they are interesting. And we all know just how boring an interesting movie can be. That's good. However, to be fair, these films are not without merit. And these are both fairly, one of these is fairly famous. Million Dollar Legs, released in July of 1932, written by Joseph L. Mankiewicz and Henry Myers.
Yes.
Klopstokia, a faraway country presided over by W.C. Fields, is on the verge of bankruptcy and is persuaded to enter the Los Angeles Olympics. So that's one.
In May
of 33, also written by Joseph L. Mankiewicz and Henry Myers.
Look at that guy go.
Diplomaniacs was released.
Now this I have never heard of.
I had not either. Burt Wheeler and Robert Woolsey represent the American Indians at the Geneva Peace Conference. Released 6 months prior to Duck Soup, Diplomaniacs processes a few more similarities to Duck Soup than Million Dollar Legs. For example, where Duck Soup has a big musical number, the country's going to war, Diplomaniacs also has a big number called No More War. Also, Louis Calhern portrays the villain in both films in a similar manner. Seeing Million Dollar Legs and Diplomaniacs will not enrich the quality of your lives, but it would be interesting to view the three movies as a trilogy of sorts. And you do recall what I said about interesting way back in the first paragraph. Best, Maurice. Always good to hear from Maurice Terenzio. Indeed, I feel like he should be a researcher on this show if we ever bothered to really plan what the hell we were going to talk about.
Yeah, but why start now?
Hey, in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up, we've certainly had our fair discussion of toxic masculinity and men behaving badly. And quite frankly, we would have this conversation over the many years leading up to it. And indeed, would be inspired to make a movie in no small way about it years in advance called The Lady Killers. So we would be remiss, especially because we were asked about this, if we did not address the news surrounding Chris Hardwick.
Right. Now, you know him very well.
Yes. I mean, we go back a long way. I wouldn't say that I know him very well. I have not seen him in quite some time. We have several close mutual friends. And like I said, we go back all the way to college. And we, the three of us, work together on Spectres, of course. You know, for those who don't know, his ex-girlfriend came forward, accused him of years of abuse, emotional and sexual abuse, and his wife has come forward to defend him. So my first blush comment is, you know, of course a wife is going to defend you. Bill Cosby's wife defended him. That's not to say that I know that these claims are true. That's not it. But
right.
I wish we didn't even bother to have in the news a wife coming forward to defend. Judge Roy Moore, the pedophile who ran for Senate in Alabama, his wife issued several passionate defenses of her husband and how he could not possibly have done this long before she ever knew him.
Right.
And indeed, isn't that the point, right? These are things that happened before Chris was, or did not happen, but are alleged to have happened before Chris was married.
Right.
Chris has been very open and has written some, for some people, very inspiring articles about his battles with alcoholism and his recovery.
Right.
And he did indeed go to a great deal of therapy and try to work at underlying causes of, you know, his addiction. I would say this from having read articles that he wrote and interviews that he did, because this guy is prolific. This guy seems like there's at times there are four or five of him working 24 yes. hours a day because of all he for a while was hosting every single show on television and publishing every single pop culture article that was being read. And hosting every single podcast on the web. So he was very, very busy. And what occurred to me back then, just as someone who really likes this guy had been friends with him for some time, was, you know, I really hope for his sake that he has not replaced one addiction with another.
Right. That's often the case.
Alcoholism with workaholism. Yeah,
right.
And riding that intense energy that came with kicking booze and with losing immediately 20 pounds. I mean, he immediately lost 20 pounds in weight as soon as he got off the booze. And that gave him so much energy he never knew that he had before. And but these are all manifestations of some kind of underlying problem. What I never heard, and I could be wrong in saying that he didn't, so I'm not saying that he didn't do this, but what I never saw him personally write about, be interviewed about, talk about, was going through a 12-step program, going through rehab, going through something like that, doing that work, the 12-step,
right.
and continuing to be part of, because as we know, if you're a recovered alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic. So you always go to those meetings. You always do them. This is why you celebrate the birthdays, right? Why you get the cakes every year.
The coins.
Because it is a major accomplishment each day, week, month, year that you continue to stay sober, it doesn't become less of an accomplishment the further you are away from that last drink. It does not. And it's still something to be celebrated and to be, you know, commended because it continues to always be hard work and incredibly important work.
Right.
And going to those meetings and doing that work also makes it, I think, somewhat easier for other people to do the work as well.
And be inspired and follow.
Yeah, follow.
And it, this is why
it builds community.
You have. Right.
So,
and that's why you have a sponsor.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've got a really funny story about that, but to share with you. But I never heard him talk about this. And so, you know, we famously had a president in the 2000s. You might remember him, George W. Bush. And he was at one time an alcoholic. And again, I always get nervous when people refer to themselves in past tense as an alcoholic. You are an alcoholic because it's an illness. And even after sobriety, you don't say you were an alcoholic. You are an alcoholic.
Right.
That's how those meetings begin, right? And then you say how long it's been since you've drank. And so that you really appreciate the achievement of it. But we had a president, right, who did not go, he famously did not go through rehab. He did not go through a recovery program. He did not go through 12 steps. He, by his own proud admission, beat alcoholism through the love of a good woman and a good book. I believe that book was Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, but I can't be sure.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Nevertheless, there were many times where that man's behavior made you realize that you were watching a dry drunk.
Right. That phrase, dry drunk, echoed many times through the administration.
And it echoed through my head many times over the years when people we both know who would work with or for Chris Hardwick would express certain experiences they had with him.
Right.
And tough, challenging experiences they would have with him.
Right.
Where they would express feelings of being abused by him. And and I always thought to myself, that really sounds like the behavior of a dry drunk.
Right. That you've given up the alcohol, but not the underlying
schmeal. Those woundings, they're seeking expression and they're going to find them. And they're going to find them through alternative avenues. And those avenues are going to be ultimately every bit as destructive. I mean, look at what is happening to Chris Hardwick in his career as a result. And So that's the only part that I really want to just, you know, comment on is that it's, you know, this is why this is why the 12-step program and the long commitment to it. And for people who are relatives of those, right? Al-Anon, right?
Mm-hmm. Al-Anon.
Why it's so important. And there is no shame in feeling absolutely all right and still going to those meetings. It is not a security blanket. It is not something to feel ashamed about. No. If anything, go there so that you can continue to be celebrated for the hard work that you are continuing to do, even if it doesn't feel like it's hard work for you anymore.
Right. It's still technically hard work. Always hard work.
It's always hard work. And you deserve the pat on the back, if nothing else. If nothing else. And then when you're in the habit of doing it, well, then when there are days that are harder, and when there are days where things are going wrong that seem to have nothing to do with your alcoholism, because indeed, maybe you're not getting the desire to have a drink, but nevertheless might still tie in to the original woundings that led to their expression through alcoholism because of a difficult work relationship or personal relationship or an experience that you had out in the world or an encounter or confrontation or whatever it is. If you're in that habit of going and rolling up your sleeves and doing that work week after week, month after month, then you'll start to be able to realize, oh, hey, another penny just dropped. This might be some part of my personality that's tied in with what led me to alcoholism in the first place.
Right.
So
right.
It can be fun. Sometimes I think it can be fun, right? Because it is a journey of self-discovery. And as we know, any
right.
journey of self-discovery at times is really, really painful. And at other times, it's really, really joyous.
And a delight.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
When you discover something that you had before hidden from yourself.
So that's all I got. Was there anything that you felt or thought that you wanted
no,
to add when you heard about this?
And you can't go, but people go, oh, I was drunk. So you absolve yourself of the responsibility. I think that's always a tough one in terms of past relationships. Now, of course, he came forth with, he still had in his phone, his possession, the texts where she cheated on him, which isn't really an excuse for what she experienced. But there, you know, it's such a...
But let me ask you that. Why would you still have that phone?
Yeah, well, that's another question.
I change my phone
right?
every couple of years, and I don't get to keep the text. I mean, this is all such strange stuff. It's not letting things go.
Right. I'm also very bad at organization, so I stumble upon photos from 2006 that when I switched phones recently, there was all these photos. I had no idea were in some back memory. When my phone said memory full, I had to search out that all of these obscure photos were still stuck in my phone. So theoretically, perhaps he wasn't holding on to this, but, you know, whatever the case is.
I've been reading David Sedaris's diaries. I can't remember the name of the book off the top of my head right now, but one of my favorite little excerpts is... you know, I always love really hilarious Amy Sedaris stories. And it was when David Sedaris took his sister Amy to meet Hugh, who, for the first time, right after they started dating. And of course, Hugh is now David Sedaris' longstanding life partner. But
right.
this was shortly after they went out for the first time. And he brought Amy to a lunch where Hugh was with... his best friend and to meet David Sedaris, and David was bringing Amy to meet Hugh. And as soon as Amy walks in, she sees Hugh drinking wine and says, "You're drinking wine? Sometimes I really hate being your sponsor. I really do." Really loud in public. Yeah, I love it.
My God. That's the first meeting?
Yeah, that's the first meeting. That's one of my favorite. I've got two other really of my all-time favorite Amy Sedaris ones, but I'll just share one more with you right now. When she was voted one of New York's most eligible bachelorettes for one of the big magazines. I don't remember which one. But, you know, the five most eligible bachelorettes in New York. And, you know, they're all like... you know, highfalutin, you know, they're fashion models, they're titans of industry, you know, they're all big, big deals. And
right.
and of course, they all go through the wardrobe and the hair and the makeup to be made up to look like a million damn bucks for the photo spread for the magazines. And Amy Sedaris is going last. So she watches all of them get made up and dressed up and, you know, accessorized and go through the photos. So she goes into makeup. And the makeup artist says, "Is there anything special you want?" And Amy Sedaris says, "Yeah, I want to look like someone just beat the living shit out of me."
and
she was determined. And so that's what they did with, you know, cracked lip, busted tooth, black eye, you know, bleeding. And that's the photo spread. But the story doesn't end there. It only begins there because she went out into the world. Looking like that afterwards, figuring she is going to get so much reaction and cause so much turmoil Nobody says a thing to her on the streets of New York at all.
Oh, my gosh.
Finally, she goes into a supermarket. Nobody's saying anything. I mean, she's getting some looks, but nobody's saying anything. Finally, she's waiting in this long checkout line. She picks the longest checkout line. And the checkout clerk keeps glancing up and then notices with some shock and then keeps glancing over and keeps glancing over. And finally, you know, it's Amy's turn to check out. And the clerk finally can't hold back anymore. And for the first time since she's left the studio, somebody says this to her. The clerk says, "Ma'am, I don't mean to pry, but are you all right?" And Amy Sedaris breaks into a huge grin and says, "Can you believe it? I'm finally in love."
Oh my God, that's horrible.
All right.
That is so dark.
Hey, we talked a lot in months past about the franchise known as Star Trek. And
yes.
A lot of news since we last talked about the expanding Star Trek TV universe. There are apparently four, count them, four Discovery-ish spinoffs in the works.
Right.
Which is odd because this is in the wake of what some of us think was a really terrible show, but also in the wake of a show that fired its showrunners yet again. Always a good sign that the parent company is pleased with the direction you've taken. So,
yes.
Alex Kurtzman, you know, who has been writing and producing the movies.
Tell him.
With J.J. Abrams, you know, producing. He is taking over from Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, who took over at the helm of the drama from Brian Fuller, who got fired, right?
Right,
And Kurtzman will take over as showrunner on season two. He was already an executive producer of Discovery, but not the showrunner. And not calling the shots on a daily basis.
Day to day, steering that ship.
And not only that, but Akiva Goldsman, who was always Kurtzman's right hand and was the director indeed of the season one finale, he's been fired because apparently Goldsman clashed with everyone. Style did not mesh. So all that's going on while at the same time they're breaking the news that they're going to do four, I think all access shows. The rumors are, maybe a Khan series, maybe a Captain Lorca series, a Captain Georgiou series, which would be great because indeed, Michelle Yeoh from the very get-go is one of the best things about Discovery. So, that'd be cool. Rainn Wilson announced publicly, yes, I would be very much in favor of doing a Harry Mudd series. Now, whether he was just doing that to plant the idea or whether because that's in the works, we don't know. But then amidst all that, of course, is the rumor about Picard's return.
Yes, that just dumped into my inbox from the feeds that I get, my news feeds, that Sir Patrick Stewart coming back as Jean-Luc Picard, which,
so,
he says he's keen to do it, too.
So I don't know what that means, though. I mean, he's saying he's never watched Discovery, but he's going to have to for a very important reason that will soon become clear. So does this mean more time travel kind of thing? I mean, honestly, I know everybody's older, but if Patrick Stewart's willing to do it, could we not just get that crew back and do more Next Generation on TV? Why not?
Why not? And even if it's a Discovery Next Gen mashup,
I don't know how with the different times, but you could do something where it's a storyline that spans the ages. I've always wanted to do that. That's what I always thought would be an amazing miniseries for Trek, is a story that spanned the different generations.
Across, do you have a single character who somehow
maybe,
a historian going
maybe,
through?
Maybe. And then, but then each episode, like say it's a four or a five episode arc, and each one focused on a different cast. You know, a movie.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like an 8-hour miniseries. Go ahead.
But I mean, we've already established that there is a parallel universe Trek that J.J. Abrams set up. So theoretically, that giant wormhole-y thing can get you back and forth through all different Trek universes.
Well, there's many of parallel universes because we also have the Mirror universe that that it took all of 6 episodes before Discovery said, we better go there to save our show. anyway, so much news to watch. It'll be really interesting. And again, it'll be interesting as the owner of CBS and Paramount try to merge those two things and see how it ties into the big screen universe. If it does at all, we'll see. We'll see.
If it does, we'll see.
Because there's the Marvel universe on the small screen. And there's very few ways in which it really bothers to try to tie in to the big screen universe. You know, it doesn't contradict, and there are references to it, and there are Easter eggs to it. But the story, other than a couple of seasons, really, of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., on ABC, certainly the Netflix Marvel Universe, the Defenders Universe, plot-wise, I mean, they're independent. I mean, they're completely independent. And so you're not missing out on anything from the movie universe by not watching the Netflix shows and vice versa. But I finally caught up on the Marvels as much as I could on Netflix. Which really took me some time because, you know, that Iron Fist series came out.
Yeah, so you're watching that? I just caught a couple episodes.
No, because that was the single worst show that has ever been produced for any medium ever. And that actor who plays it, I mean, I hate blaming actors.
Mm-hmm.
But dear God, he's horrible. I mean, and beyond horrible, just... the fuck ever told you to pursue this?
Oh my God.
Can I go back time?
No. Okay, you can't blame actors because there's so many things involved. There's the script, the direction,
why you would ever want to just whine your way through it. But anyway, it is terrible. It's truly terrible. And it's stunning how terrible it is because Daredevil season one, very good. Jessica Jones season one, maybe even better. As we said, you know, the only thing that made Jessica Jones seem not as great as it was because its villain couldn't live up to the big shadow cast by Vincent D'Onofrio from that Daredevil season. But then you get to Luke Cage season one and you go, wow, this is a great show with a great style all its own. And it's socially relevant. Oh, my God, what they are up to here. And then they hit us with Iron Fist. I guess Daredevil 2 came out first, and that was a bit of a mess, Daredevil season 2. It took a while before it got going. We loved seeing our buddy Peter Shinkoda as Nobu again. But you know, there's some weak players in that. But you're right. You can't blame the actor, because it is fascinating that, for example, the actor who plays Foggy Nelson is so bad in season 2 of Daredevil, but he's very good in season 2 of some of these other shows. He's very good in Defenders. He's very good in Jessica Jones season 2. So it really comes down a lot of times to how actors, you're right, and I always say this, are subject to the directing and the editing and the acting. And
and nobody goes out of their way to make a bad thing. As we have,
I would disagree with you that I do think they went out of their way on Iron Fist. What is the worst choice we could make across the board? Because it's the only, and my God, they had a hell of a batting average.
Well, I can only think they're being somehow curtailed by the larger Marvel universe of how this thing fits in.
Because, I don't think so, because it doesn't fit in. It doesn't. And
well, that's just it. I think they probably had an idea, and they went, no, you can't do that because it'll overlap this, and this on these projects.
So I would say maybe you're right then if it was being curtailed by their plans for the Defenders universe, because all this was building in to that gigantic miniseries where they bring all these heroes together, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, the Iron Fist, and they do. They have a Defenders series, which turns out to be, I think, the third lowest watched Netflix series, period. Not among Marvel, among all series, and it's the single biggest drop-off in viewership from one week to the next of any series Netflix has ever created. It wasn't, and it was a huge step forward from Iron Fist. It was a lot better than Iron Fist. But here's the problem with it, is you bring those four heroes together, and the show has an odd lack of any discernible style. Those shows had created their own style, and Defenders has none. I realized at its at several points in the series, in the Defenders series, what do you get when you cross Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist? You get
what?
Iron Fist.
Right. Oh my gosh.
God bless.
Well, you know, this
Kristen
this
Witter
could be a case.
Well, God bless Kristen Witter and Jessica Jones. She comes off the best. She manages to salvage everything she's in that show. But
and she's got a great character too. I mean, that.
But they all did in their own shows. Daredevil did. Luke Cage did.
Yeah.
But oh my God, Luke Cage is boring in Defenders. It's really, really shocking. You think, and it makes you realize, hey, that trick they pulled off in the first Avengers movie, bringing these characters together, and not only bringing them together, but making them all more interesting together than they were individually. Holy shit, that was an accomplishment.
Okay, well, you know, in improv comedy, there's a thing, a phenomena that happens where four of the most talented, funniest improvisers join in one team and go on stage that everybody backs down because they have such adoration for the other performers that nobody brings their A game. And so those shows tend to be terrible, even though individually these guys can rock the house by themselves. I've been in improv shows where it's the funniest people you've ever seen not be funny because, well, the other funny guy will be funny. So nobody's funny. So I wonder if the Defenders is suffering from super talented master improv malaise.
Well, I would say that it's something more akin to a plot being imposed upon them that they're all paying off versus what you're able to do when it's a show focusing on that one character, which is to reveal the character through the storyline. Now it's now they're all prop pieces being put through their paces in service of a plot. And that's why I'm saying that Joss Whedon did a hell of a job in that first Avengers movie of making it seem like we were learning more about the characters by bringing them together. You know, rather than paying off the story, unlike the most recent Avengers, Infinity War, which was all about just imposing a plot on them a decade in the making. But that first Avengers is a truly, I think, great film. And and I'm saying again now, having watched Defenders, I'm just appreciating again how hard it is to do that. I would like to point out that Jessica Jones season 2 drops after the Defenders. And it's really quite good. It's really quite good.
Right.
And it's the one Netflix show where everyone in it is good. The writing and the directing and the tone and the style and the themes being explored are all, I think, really spot on. They're on the mark. And I do look forward to starting Luke Cage season 2, which just dropped this week.
Fantastic. Well, I got some catching up to do.
I am very excited. Tonight here in the States, Dean, season 2 of Westworld comes to a conclusion. And I'm looking forward to that. So I'm going to hold off on discussing it at all until the finale of this season drops. But I did finally catch up on the HBO series adapted for television by David E. Kelly of course, Ally McBeal and my beloved Boston Legal, based on a beloved bestseller from Australia, set in Australia, called Big Little Lies.
No.
And
that's weird. I haven't seen this.
And this is a show that got transplanted to Monterey, California. And it was the book was purchased by Reese Witherspoon, who purchased it for herself as a vehicle and then brought in David E. Kelly to adapt it for television. It stars Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Shailene Woodley, who's very much the standout, and Laura Dern, who, it must be admitted now, is nothing short of a national treasure. I'm willing to really appreciate now just how great not only Laura Dern is, but has always been. She is a genuine force of nature. One thing about the show that's hilarious is also in it is Hong Chau, who just got a bunch of award nominations for Downsizing. So in other words, this is a show, Reese Witherspoon, Laura Dern, Hong Chau, what do they all have in common? They were leading ladies for Alexander Payne. What an odd thing this is, and he has nothing to do with this show. Instead, like I said, it's David E. Kelly. But adapted from a book by Leanne Moriarty, it focuses on this community, this really tense, backstabbing community of mothers of toddlers who are in like kindergarten, and the high-stakes, backstabbing world of parenting toddlers. And a murder takes place, and the whole first season is told in flashbacks. The season ends with the murder and the release of all the suspects.
Wow!
And
okay,
it's not
now. Now this is the Monterey version, so it's a redo of the Australian one.
But I gather that the Australian book dealt with many of the same themes, which are about abuse and spousal abuse and relationship violence and things like this.
Where and domestic violence in Australia is one in four relationships. So I would think that has a bigger resonance.
Do you know that in teen dating relationships in the U.S., it's the exact same figure. One in four teen dating relationships are abusive. Yes.
Good Lord.
So anyway, so it deals with some interesting themes. I felt the show, I think it was seven episodes, easily should have only been five. There's a lot of padding in it.
No. Damn it.
But, you know, those women are all really good performers, and it's kind of fun to get to see them do stuff that's worthy of them. And it's also funny that it's almost impossible for any man in the show to make a mark. They're all pretty milk toast. The men that they cast intentionally, not all of them, but it's funny. And Meryl Streep's joining the cast in season two. So, I mean, this thing is only going to get bigger. But, interesting. The themes are interesting. It's fun enough. I enjoyed it. Though, like I said, even at seven episodes, boy, it felt padded.
God. Okay. Well, that's I don't know if that's a ringing endorsement of it, but I will check it out.
Now, we are going to have to discuss a whole shit ton of movies on next week's show because we're almost out of time, but I am curious. Have you seen any of the big blockbusters of late?
Yes. The Deadpools, the Infinity Wars, just finally caught up with Solo.
We discussed many times the Infinity Wars and the Deadpools. So what about the Solo? Mm-hmm. What did you think of that?
I was surprisingly engaged and I had enjoyment in the movie of the enjoyment. But, I think it was just that. It was working very hard to be enjoyable. So what a great achievement to have a joyful movie.
Yeah, if only it had cost hundreds of millions of dollars less, that would be an achievement. I again, keep coming up against, I mean, you know I'm reviewing the movie for how it was made and not for what ended up, but there's a degree to which you're, you know, they're begging for that. Yeah. I finally, ultimately, voted thumbs up on the movie. After weeks, it took me. I kept going between kind of thumbs down and thumb halfway up, and then a voted thumbs up. Yeah. But it, you know, the first half of the movie is more hardworking than joyful, and then by the second half, it pays off in some kind of seemingly effortless joy. But I gotta tell you, I keep coming back to, I have a strong feeling the Lord and Miller film would have been more fun and more interesting. And why not ride the horse in the direction it was going rather than double your budget by reshooting 75% of it before you've even started editing? I don't understand.
Well, and I think it was the worry of their work style, right? That there'd be one take for the studios, one take for the script, and then improvise to find something light and joyful. You know, it's an exploratory way of working. I've worked that way in theater and on screen. But when you got a $100 million franchise and action sequences that need
$100 million, you know, I mean, it was going to be $200 anyway. It's $400 because of them redoing everything. But I have a phrase that I've just picked up from listening to people talk about scouting reports of basketball players coming out of college and going to the pros. And I love this phrase. It's about how people traditionally always used to look for players with high ceilings. You know, potential. You want potential. Right. You want the next great star. But you know what really great teams do? They draft, the really successful teams, they draft players with high floors, not high ceilings. So in other words, they may never be very good at anything, but they won't have any weaknesses. And that means they can play right away. And I feel like with these big franchises, yeah, we're trying to make stuff that has a high floor and we don't care about the ceiling. And it's a new way of approaching what? Risk management.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's counterintuitive in risk management in that you are allowing a creative artistic expression to develop in the light of, good God, are you making your days? Are you hitting your dailies? What, you know, set pieces can you even handle? These, you know, 25-minute storyboarded to death sequences that will require stunts and explosions and all that sort of thing. If you're every day just screwing around with actors, making up lines and finding lighthearted moments, you know, those two elements clash in the minds of risk management Harvard eggheads who are sitting there bean counting and looking at the dailies shitting their pants.
You know, so, this is one of the reasons why I must say I've found actually increasingly the Mission Impossible franchise refreshing. Because at first, obviously, they would bring in auteurs like Brian De Palma, John Woo, and those movies somewhat underwhelming. And then they bring in J.J. Abrams, a budding auteur who needs to prove himself on the big screen. And he does with Mission Impossible 3, which was really good. And then part four, we bring in an auteur, Ghost Protocol, which I think is not only the best of that series, but we would, I think, agree, a great, great action movie. And what's the auteur they bring in for that? Brad Bird, who's only done animated movies. And he does this amazing, amazing movie. Now, his second live-action movie, not amazing, Tomorrowland with George Clooney. But again, that's working for a producer called Disney in live-action, which brings us right back to Solo and how Disney does not let their budding auteurs, Lord and Miller, have the free rein to even finish the expression of what they're going after. No, they've got to impose risk management on them. And I feel like that's what happened to Brad Bird with Tomorrowland, whereas working for producer Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise was smart enough to say, no, I'm going after the high ceiling that you have.
Right.
And,
right.
And I was thinking about that because Brad Bird, of course, is back to animation after Tomorrowland. He just did, after what was it, 15 years, Incredibles 2, which is which is great fun. And, oh my God, I loved seeing it on the big screen, if for no other reason than Michael Giacchino's score of these Incredibles movies. Like, I don't remember anything from the first Incredibles at all. I don't remember a single thing, honestly, other than, oh yeah, that was funny. And the music was so cool. And, and again, this movie's funny. It's oddly touching at times. But again, just such a delight to get to sit down in a movie theater and let that sound and that fantastic sound design that Pixar always comes up with, but surround you. But how interesting that Brad Bird would be back, you know.
Well, you play to your strengths, right? And you could see why he would get an action film, because often the storyboard is your platform, your trampoline from which you can jump off of. And to my mind, Brad has, you know, from his days at The Simpsons all the way on up, has always worked really well with understanding the workflow of the storyboards to animate to
and
your mechanicals.
And understanding comedic timing. Because
comedic timing
Ghost Protocol uses humor really well.
So well.
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before. You know, Tom Cruise is now in his 50s. I just saw Made in America from last year, the movie that Doug Liman directed about Barry Seal, the TWA pilot who was recruited by the CIA and found himself, you know, creating basically the Iran-Contra scandal. But, you know, what's really been impressive to watch with Tom Cruise as he's moved into his 50s is the elegance and grace that he has when it comes to his comedic timing.
It's true, right?
Because
you forget that.
He still has that manic energy that he pushes off against, but he has such a relaxed comedic delivery and his timing's impeccable. And Brad Bird, through, as you said, The Simpsons, The Incredibles, and through his live action stuff, even at times in Tomorrowland, the comedic timing is there.
Right. Right. And to know it.
The counter to this, and this is where we're over time, so this is where we'll stop.
We're over time.
But there was another animated film that I saw, and it was directed by someone we talked about last week, though I didn't end up having any of his films because I couldn't pick one in my top 10 comedies. But it was Wes Anderson's new movie, Isle of Dogs.
Oh, yeah. What did you think of this?
Not only might it be my favorite Wes Anderson movie, and not only might it be one of my five favorite animated films ever, it really, two things really occurred to me about this. One is that it was Fantastic Mr. Fox that revitalized Wes Anderson. He had fallen into a real downward spiral of his innate patterning and almost myopic world creation through, you know, that was the Life Aquatic and then Bottoms Out with the train movie, Darjeeling Limited. And it's, and it's Fantastic Mr. Fox that allows him to break out. And when he comes out the other side, he then makes Moonrise Kingdom and Grand Budapest Hotel. And now he goes back to animation for Isle of Dogs. If the improvement in his live action work, and by the way, Grand Budapest Hotel might be my top film of the decade, but if his live action improvement after this animated film is equal to what it was after his last animated film, oh my God, what we are in for next time. But what was also really interesting was the debate over Isle of Dogs, over when is something homage and when is it cultural appropriation?
Aha!
Because there's a big controversy around this. Because
I did not know that.
The film's set in Japan, and a lot of people were very offended by, quote-unquote, the cultural appropriation of it. And I think it's hilarious that because it's in animation, and which brings to mind Japanese anime, that now it's cultural appropriation, as opposed to... No, it's exactly what it was in Grand Budapest Hotel and what it's been with every Wes Anderson thing. This is not set in Japan. This is set in the mind of Wes Anderson. All of these things exist only in the mind of Wes Anderson. We are visiting one place and one place alone. Did you really get any sense that you were visiting Eastern Europe during the early part of the 20th century in Grand Budapest Hotel? No, you were entering the playpen of Wes Anderson's mind.
Right.
It was the Wes Anderson imaginary puppet show.
Right. So I can't imagine then this is why I don't think I heard this argument of cultural appropriation. I can't believe it exists.
Yeah. I mean, it's really an odd, I find that argument becomes more interesting when you're talking about, for example, something like, Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill movies,
right.
Where you're sitting there watching going, well, I'm glad that he loves all these Hong Kong movies, but instead of just ripping off the Hong Kong movies, couldn't he make a Quentin Tarantino movie?
Well, but he was exploring, I mean, the camera technique is different and how you sequentially shoot these action things
but
are different.
But I could understand that as more of a...
Right.
Whereas this is such a creation of Wes Anderson's mind and how his mind operates. But this movie, Isle of Dogs, it is it's spectacular. My God.
Really?
Yeah. It's
good Lord.
It's very much. This has not been a bad year for movies. There have been a handful of great movies that we'll talk about next week. But this is certainly one of them. This is right up there. And
that's amazing.
And I would hope that it would stand a chance to win Best Animated Picture, but I am worried about this controversy about cultural appropriation and, the political environment in which we live.
But here's the thing. We should share the best ideas amongst us all. And if we go about shaming each other on cultural appropriation, we will be limited in our ability to move forward as a culture together. So I always, anytime somebody tries to cultural appropriate anybody, I will go, well, I'm sorry, but the Vikings came up with blank, or and how far back do you want to take that?
And again, any movie that actually deals with, again, like WALL-E or Spirited Away, in the tradition of so many great Japanese animated films, by the way, that deals with the terrors of what we're doing to this planet, not only in terms of victimizing the planet, but in terms of victimizing ourselves by cutting ourselves off not only from nature, but from our own nature. And this is what Wes Anderson is exploring in a dystopic, unnamed future. In Isle of Dogs, and doing so with delightful animation and action and comedy and taiko drumming. And it is the most perfectly conceived and constructed Wes Anderson movie. You think of all the things you like about Wes Anderson when everything is working perfectly, the set designs, the costumes, the way that every frame is so perfectly, the mise-en-scene is so perfectly constructed frame by frame, and never more so than in Isle of Dogs. Top of his game.
Well,
top
often that's
of
the case
his
with...
game.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to look for it.
All right.
Awesome.
That brings us to the end of a very, very long installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every installment that we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Are we on Facebook?
Oh, we're on Facebook. Oh, yes, we are.
Oh, we are. Oh, okay,
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Please like us.
Or poke us. No, they don't do that anymore.
No, they don't. They no poke.
So then let's, if you want to email us, like so many people do, email us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram with all the same handle. It's at Dean and Phil. Spell it the word end. Do we give great hashtag?
Hashtag we give great hashtag. Until next Fantastic. Week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.